Yeah, so as Daniel said, I'm going to be talking about a new approach we propose to look for forces with ranges of loosely nanometers, let's say angstroms to about 100 nanometers to be a bit more precise. And what we're going to do is we're going to scatter neutrons, but we're going to scatter them from slightly different targets than what people have used in the past to take advantage of coherent scattering. So this is some work with my advisor, Peter Graham, and then also Giorgio Grotta, who's an experimentalist. And I think one of the exciting things about this project is that we're now collaborating with Giorgio and some people at NIST towards actually building this. So with any luck, we might have real physics being done within a few years. But that's getting ahead of ourselves. What am I going to talk about today? I'll start with a very brief introduction to new forces. What kinds of new forces are we talking about? Why are these something you might care about? How have people looked for them in the past? And then the bulk of the talk is going to focus on what I'm calling here single material targets. So what I mean by that is that these are going to be some targets that consist just of a single element. These are really nice. They're very easy to think about, to describe. It's easy to understand how this proposal works. Unfortunately, it also may or may not be possible to actually build any. And so near the end of the talk, I will switch to what I'm going to call two material targets, where you use a combination of multiple materials. These are a lot less pretty in terms of how everything works, but the nice thing is that you can definitely build them. Okay, so let's go ahead and start with sort of background. We all know about four fundamental forces, right? Gravity, electromagnetism, and then these two weird nuclear ones. In principle, though, there can be others. And there's a lot of possible such forces. A common way that you might get them is if you introduce some new scalar to the standard model or beyond the standard model. And there's two up to dimension four, two vertices that can have with fermions. So if your scalar is some field phi, you can either have a phi psi bar psi coupling, or you can throw a gamma 5 in there. The first of these is a scalar coupling. The latter is a pseudoscalar. And the key difference here being that the latter depends on spins. The first doesn't. In this talk, I'm going to focus on things that just couple in the scalar way, right, that are spin independent. But I'll note that to a certain extent, you can extend our work to the pseudoscalar case. It's just trickier because you need to polarize things. So we haven't done this in too much detail, although I can say a few words at the end if people are interested. In the case of these spin-independent forces, though, what you get generically is some Yukawa potential. So this looks like some product of couplings. Then there's a 1 over r as usual, but then there's an exponential suppression, right? E to the minus mu r, where mu is the mass of your new scalar. Actually, in this talk, I'm mostly going to prefer to talk about things not in terms of masses, but in terms of lengths. Length scales are just going to be convenient, since we're often talking about materials with physical lengths in them. And so then you can think of this as some e to the minus r over lambda, right? If you see lambda anywhere, what I mean is the range of the force. It's just the inverse mass. You can get macroscopic forces at these ranges in other ways. For example, people talk about modifications to gravity resulting from extra dimensions. We aren't realistically sensitive enough to probe that sort of thing, but maybe one day someone will be. But this is sort of a nice prototypical, nice characteristic model that I'll focus on. All right, so how have people looked for these in the past? This is a plot from a nice review, with one exception we'll get to in a second. So at very short ranges, right, very heavy mediators, you look for these things in colliders. You just look for the new particle that's mediating this. Fine. As you get to longer ranges, actually the best way to look for things is neutron scattering, but for whatever reason, this review chose to ignore neutron scattering. Instead, they talk about tricks you can play with atoms. This is actually a proposal. It hasn't been done before, but you can do Mossbauer spectroscopy, and these kinds of new forces would modify electron energy levels. And then as you get to longer ranges, you get into sort of more traditional cantilever or torsion balance type experiments that you may have heard about, where you're looking at forces between some big test masses, and you're really just measuring the force directly. Eventually, you want to switch to geophysics, where you're looking at effects of the Earth as a whole, or even things between planets, but these are at much larger ranges. I'm going to focus precisely on this sort of nanometer type regime here, right? And I'll go ahead and zoom in there at what current constraints look like. So down below, there's going to be this cutoff around 10 nanometers. Below about 10 nanometers, you see a few different lines, which all come from neutron scattering or different neutron type experiments. Good. And then above 10 nanometers, you'll notice there's this sort of noticeable change in slope, right, in terms of the relationship between how sensitive you can be in the range. And these are various experiments that look at forces between relatively macroscopic masses, right, between many atoms. These three colored lines here are relatively recent things. So the green line is just some slightly more updated limits from scattering neutrons. The light blue line is a slightly different thing. It's still neutrons, but it's doing neutron interferometry. And you can measure essentially the index of refraction of neutrons inside of materials. That's some very recent work. And then the red line is a rough estimate of where our proposal is going to lie. But of course, I'll show you more precise lines later. But I want to focus for now on this distinction between the regimes below and above 10 nanometers, because there's a qualitative difference in how you do these experiments. When you're looking at ranges below about 10 nanometers, what people look at are 1-1 interactions. They're interactions of neutrons with a single nucleus. Actually, even here, this isn't quite 1-1. The neutron interacts with all of the nuclei within that nucleus, because we're not looking at momentum transfers below a femtometer where they're distinguishable. But roughly speaking, you can think of this as an interaction between a point-like neutron and a point-like xenon nucleus. Above 10 nanometers, it's much more effective to look at collections of atoms. And it's much more effective because you just win based on the product of the number of atoms on each side, right? You just have many things interacting with many other things. And so the sort of characteristic experiment here is you have some sort of cantilever where you have a little mass and it can move around and you place a test mass next to it and you see how hard they pull on each other. That's really great when you have lots of atoms, but as you get to shorter ranges, it becomes problematic for two reasons. One of them is just that there's not that many atoms you can fit in here, right? If you talk about a 1 nanometer range force, then these masses, well, you're only winning from them being about a nanometer across, and you can't fit that many atoms in there, but you could still fit some. The other problem, though, is that they get insurmountable backgrounds from the fact that real materials are just never electromagnetically neutral at these scales. In practice, even if you have no net charge, you're always going to have some higher order multipole moment that matters at these length scales. And so you just can't really do these experiments below about 10 nanometers.
So is there like a reason like the transition is like a 10 nanometer instead of like an angstrom? Like where does this factor 100 come from?
Sorry, I couldn't quite hear you.
Oh, I'm asking like whether like the transition should be like somewhere 10 nanometer or like more close to an angstrom. Is there like a reason why this factor of 100 comes from?
Good, yeah. I'm not sure I have a good fundamental reason for why it's a factor of 100 specifically. And in fact, if you talk to Giorgio, he'll tell you that arguably you shouldn't even believe these experiments on the right at 10 nanometers, and really you should be skeptical up to 30 or 100 nanometers. But yeah, I don't have a great sense for why. I think, you know, this comes down to some detailed material properties and how well you can really make materials perfectly flat and perfectly uniform at these length scales. But I don't have a good fundamental reason for why it should be 10 nanometers specifically, yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So what we're going to try and do in this proposal is look at a sort of intermediate regime right between these two extremes. And so we're going to look at still neutron scattering, right? So it's going to be the interaction of a single neutron with something. But instead of interacting with a single nucleus, it's going to interact with a collection of nuclei or a collection of atoms. And this will allow us to set significantly stronger constraints between, again, about an angstrom. Below an angstrom, this is nonsense because there's only one atom within an angstrom. And up to, again, we'll say something like 30 nanometers, but you can debate exactly what the upper cutoff should be. And the reason that this will be advantageous is that the neutron is so nice electromagnetically, right? Unlike atoms, it doesn't have a bunch of charges in it. It doesn't have certainly a net charge, but it doesn't even have a significant electric dipole moment. It does have a significant magnetic dipole moment. We'll come back to that a little bit, and it has a charge radius that will matter. But nonetheless, it is much less electromagnetically interacting than atoms are. And so it turns out to be advantageous to use it in this intermediate regime. Okay, so let's talk about how exactly you can do this. And again, as I said earlier, we'll start with these sort of idealized targets with only a single type of atom in them. Here's a sketch of mostly just a typical neutron scattering experiment with one caveat specific to us. So you have some source of neutrons, and typically this is a nuclear reactor. Nuclear reactors spit out lots of neutrons. It could also be a spallation source, but probably for us, a nuclear reactor is a better choice. Then you have some kind of moderator. You want to cool down the neutrons. We'll come back to this, but the basic point here is that you want neutrons that are moving relatively slowly, and the things that come directly out of, well, actually, reactors have some moderator in them immediately, but you want to cool them down even a little bit more ideally. And so I think a standard thing that's used these days is you pass neutrons through some hydrogen. They don't quite thermalize in it, but it's the same idea. They interact with some cold atoms, and they come out, on average, moving more slowly. The problem is that neutron sources can't really be focused, right? Again, because neutrons don't have a lot of electromagnetic interactions, they just kind of fly out in every direction at once. And so if you want to form a beamline, the way that you do this is in, roughly speaking, the stupidest way possible, which is that you have two screens in a row that absorb neutrons, and you cut little pinholes in both of them. And if you only look at the neutrons that pass through both pinholes, then you have something that kind of looks like a beam, right? It's not great. You lose a lot of neutrons in the process, but this is what you can do. Along with choosing neutrons that are going in one direction to have a beam, you also want them to have at least vaguely similar velocities. Yes, question.
What's Q again?
Good. So Q is the momentum of the neutrons. Yes, right. And yeah, so it's about an inverse angstrom. Again, I'm going to prefer to keep things in length scales because we'll compare this to something in just a second. Good. So that momentum is set by the velocity of the neutrons. You don't need them to have terribly uniform velocities. It's okay to have some energy spread for us. But still, you don't want a full thermal spectrum. And the way that you choose neutron velocities is kind of clever. You can take a cylinder, and a cylinder of something that absorbs neutrons, and you imagine cutting a sort of helical channel in it, right? Something that winds around as it cuts through the cylinder. If you just have the cylinder sitting there and you shine neutrons into it, none of them are going to get through because they're all going to hit the walls of this helical channel. But if you start to rotate the cylinder at just the right speed relative to the velocity of the neutrons, then a neutron that's passing through will see this channel rotate out in front of it so that it's like it goes straight through. And so all of a sudden, neutrons with specific velocities can pass through this thing, and everything else gets absorbed. So it's this nice, clever technique that gives you relatively uniform velocities. All right, so you have some beam of neutrons. Now it's going to hit some target. And as this picture sort of suggests, that target is going to have little grains inside of it. We'll come back to that. Most of the neutrons fly right through. This is important because if you scatter too many of your neutrons, then it becomes very common for neutrons to scatter multiple times, and that's messy. So most of your neutrons just pass through, but occasionally some of them scatter. And the ones that scatter fly out at different angles, and we measure the distribution of what those angles is. All right. So this is a standard neutron scattering experiment. Now,
does it matter that the beam is composed mostly of neutrons? Like, say that there are some mesons in the beam. Would it mess up your experiment? The reason why I'm asking is that I know about experiments that are, well, mostly like meson experiments, that they have similar devices like without pinhole. And there's a huge problem that once you put a beam of stuff through the pinholes, the beam interacts with the walls, creates mesons, and the meson multiplicity that you create is pretty large. So you also get a beam of mesons, in particular, for instance, kaolins. And then the kaolins just like go through and they will likely interact because does it matter that
That's interesting. I had not heard that before. We are at very low energies where I wouldn't expect this to be a major issue, but maybe some amount of it occurs. I don't want to confidently claim it doesn't. I'm guessing that any target we would think about is going to be very opaque to any meson, and so they just won't get through.
They will scatter and do something. So it's true that the neutrons in the end, they are very slow, but the initial neutrons?
The neutrons are roughly room temperature as they exit a nuclear reactor. Nuclear reactors are surprisingly cold in terms of their neutron temperature. Yeah, because you don't want hot neutrons in a nuclear reactor, so they cool things down considerably in there.
Okay,
yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Other questions? Okay. Good. So let's talk about how neutrons actually interact with materials. And you've probably, I'm not sure if I've mentioned it, you've probably seen me at least write on the slides at this point a few times that the neutrons are scattering from xenon. Why xenon? So xenon is a nice, heavy, noble gas. Now, heavy is good because, as I mentioned earlier, you're interacting with the whole nucleus, and it just has a big nucleus. That's nice. But I'm going to restrict, in a lot of this talk, to scattering from noble gases because it's much simpler. And it's much simpler because noble gases have no net electron orbital angular momentum. They have no net electron spin. And actually, for the isotopes we consider, not exactly coincidentally, there's even zero nuclear spin. And that means that there's just nothing to interact with the neutron magnetic dipole moment, which is substantial. And so in the absence of any magnetic moment for the neutron to interact with, you can describe neutron scattering from such a noble element to very high precision with just two terms. One of them is hard scattering from the strong nuclear interaction. And this is hard sphere scattering. Because the strong nuclear interaction has a length scale of order femtometers, whereas we're talking about momentum transfers here. So again, that's the x-axis here, right? Momentum transfers of order inverse nanometers. Scattering from a potential that has spatial extent of order of femtometer is essentially hard sphere scattering. And so it's isotropic. You get equal amounts of scattering in every direction to something like 1 part in 10 to the 12, which is great for us. And if that was it, that would be really nice. You would have nothing scattering non-isotropically, and you could just look for deviations from that. In reality, the world's not quite so nice to us. There is scattering from the fact that the neutron has a charge radius, right? The neutron is, I can never remember which one it is. I think it's slightly more positive in the center and slightly more negative on the outside. Maybe it's the other way around. The point is there's some interaction with divergences of electric fields, and you get divergences of electric fields at the location of charges. So in particular, the electron cloud around some atom leads to an interaction with the neutron charge radius, and that actually has some non-trivial angular dependence. That being said, that angular dependence is set by the form factor, in other words, the Fourier transform of the charge distribution of the atom. That's something you can measure in other ways if you need. Also, maybe you don't even need to, because in reality, it doesn't have features at the momentum transfers that we really care about. This is something that occurs on longer length scales. In any case, this is a thing you can control. All right, and then finally here, I've also included a term from our new force, right? Which again, I'm assuming to be a Yukawa force. And this just looks like some characteristic strength, right, kappa nu, and then 1 plus the momentum transfer over the mass squared. In particular, it's roughly angle independent at small momentum transfers, and then you start to fall off with angle. So these are plotted here, right? So the green line here is nuclear scattering. You'll notice that it is way above everything else because most scattering of neutrons from noble atoms is from the strong force. Far below it, we have this red line from electromagnetism, and you'll notice that this is pretty small, though it does get more significant as you get to larger momentum transfers. And then finally, there's this blue line corresponding to the new force. And again, that's flat for a while and starts to fall off. And the key thing to note here is that we can't see the new force in this angle-independent regime. And we can't see it because we can't do lattice QCD that well. And so we can't predict what the strong force cross-section of a neutron from this atom should be to anything near the precision we would need. In other words, the location of this green line, right, how large the cross-section is just a thing we can measure. If you were only looking at very small angles, then all you would see as a result of a new force is a shift in this green line, effectively, right? It's a change in the angle-independent contribution to the neutron scattering cross-section. But that's not a thing we can see, because again, this is just a measured thing. So we need to see some deviation from being angle-independent. And for that, you need to start going to somewhat larger momentum transfers, in particular to momentum transfers that are roughly of order the mass of your mediator. And so here I'm choosing a mediator with mass of order an inverse nanometer. And so you'll see some non-trivial behavior in the new force at a momentum transfer of order an inverse nanometer. On the other hand, it's hard to see things at even larger momentum transfers because, again, new force scattering is just suppressed by the large momentum transfer at that point. This is a bit of a problem. And it's a problem because most of your scattering happens at large angles. That's not really noticeable here because I'm plotting things as cross sections per unit solid angle. And as I said, hard sphere scattering, it's essentially angle independent. But the problem is that there's not a lot of phase space at very small momentum transfers, right? When you scatter at very small angles, there's very little space. And so most of your scatters happen at order one angles. We can sort of plot things a different way to make this more apparent. If instead of plotting per unit solid angle, right, dp d omega, we look at dp d log theta, where theta is how far, like, is your angle away from the beam line, right, how much you've scattered. So this gives you an idea of scattering as a function of characteristic angle in some sense. And you'll notice that now most of your scattering really does happen at these order one angles. If you're looking for some new force, this is here at an inverse nanometer, but an inverse nanometer, but we're interested in forces with potentially even larger masses, in other words, smaller masses, in other words, smaller momentum transfers, then you're increasingly suppressed, right? Very little of your scattering happens at these small angles. And so a lot of your scattering in some sense goes to waste, right? You're not getting anything out of all of this high angle scattering because the new force is really small at these large angles anyway. And so what we would really like to do is to scatter neutrons in a way where most of your scattering events happen at the small angles where you can really see a new force. Doing that is very much the goal of our proposal. And we can do this by giving targets structure, right? These are all plotted for example, for a single atom, but if you just have a cloud of xenon as a xenon gas, it's going to look the same way. You're just sort of rescaling things, right, depending on the total number of atoms. But introducing structure can change that. And the way that this is normally described is in terms of something called a structure factor, right? So when we scatter from a collection of different things, your amplitudes are going to come in with different phases. Those phases are just the result of different path lengths when you scatter from different atoms, right? So these look like e to the I times some momentum transfer dotted into the position of the particular atom you're scattering from. When you look at a total scattering probability, you're going to add up the amplitudes from all of these atoms with these phase factors. We're looking for now at just a collection of identical atoms, so fine, the amplitudes from all of them factor out, and the thing that matters is the sum of these phases, right? Because the phases do differ from atom to atom. And so the total amount of scattering is going to be proportional to the sum of phases squared. That thing, divided by conventionally the number of total atoms, is called your structure factor. And it's useful to think about this in sort of two limits. So on the one hand, if we look, for example, at zero momentum transfer, where these phases are all the same, so you don't need to worry about the phase at all, right? Then this is just a sum of a bunch of ones. This thing is n squared, and your structure factor is n. What does that tell you? It tells you that you're coherent over all n atoms, and so your scattering is enhanced by a factor of n. By comparison, if these phases are completely random, as they would, for example, be in a typical ideal gas experiment, right? When you add up n random vectors of length unity, on average, you're going to get something of length n. Your structure factor is 1, and so there's no enhancement, right? So that's sort of, I mean, that's really the range of values that the structure factor can take, right? It ranges from 1 when you're looking at totally incoherent scattering up to a value of n when you're coherent over all n atoms that you have. A sort of analogous version of this that you might be familiar with is Bragg scattering, where you scatter from some crystal lattice, and there, at particular momentum transfers, right, you find that the phases from consecutive layers of your lattice, those phases are, well, 2 pi or multiples of, and as a result, you're completely coherent between successive layers, right? This is a sort of very familiar example for many of us. This isn't quite what we're going to do, though, right? Here, you get peaks at particular momentum transfers, but you get some peaked structure. We instead want to look at a different kind of coherence, resulting just from the momentum transfer being small enough. And so you can think of the targets we'll talk about as looking sort of like this, where you have a collection of different little blobs or grains, each of which contains many atoms, but then you have big spaces between these grains. And when you look at small angle scattering so that your momentum transfer is relatively large, what you find now is that you can be coherent over a single one of these grains because its spatial extent is fairly small compared to the momentum or the inverse momentum transfer, right? So the phases within one grain are small, but then you have large phases between different grains. As a result of that, you're going to be coherent over a grain, although you're still not going to be incoherent when you're summing between different grains. As you get to larger angles and larger momentum transfers, however, this picture breaks down, and all of a sudden you're incoherent even within grains, right? Where different atoms in this add up with meaningfully different phases, and so you have suppressed scattering at these angles. You'll notice that that's exactly the kind of behavior you want, right? It enhances scattering at small momentum transfers, but doesn't enhance it at large momentum transfers. So again, we can calculate this in terms of structure factors. Here I'm just showing an example for ideal spheres, right, with some uniform number density of atoms inside of them. The first expression is kind of a mess. I'm including it just for people that might have seen this before. Otherwise, we'll go ahead and focus on the bottom one, which is a good approximation of the upper one. Right, so you have some structure factor, which again is this enhancement of scattering, which again, we'll look at two limiting behaviors, right? If we look at the limit of zero momentum transfer, then this first term is just 4/3 pi times nr cubed, right? 4/3 pi nr cubed is just the number of atoms inside the grain. This is exactly what you'd expect. You add up all of the atoms within a grain. Conversely, as we take the momentum transfer to be large compared to the inverse radius of these grains, this factor starts to drop off precipitously, and eventually all you really have is a structure factor of about 1 from incoherent scattering. actually, most people don't include the one when they talk about structure factors, but I'm including it here just to emphasize, right, that you always have incoherent scattering. It's not like that part disappears. Okay, good. So graphically, what does this look like? So here I'm again plotting total scattering, which is essentially just nuclear scattering because that dominates, as a function of per unit solid angle, as a function of the momentum transfer. And so again, if we look at a target with no structure, that's this black dashed line, you find uniform scattering as a function of angle. Great. Now we introduce structure with spherical structures of size, let's say 10 nanometers, I think radius 10 nanometers, right? And that's this blue solid line. And you'll notice that now momentum transfers up to about inverse 10 nanometers are dramatically enhanced. And then you start to fall off. And eventually you'll see here that I've shown that actually you have less scattering. The reason for that is that I've fixed the total amount of scattering here to be constant. I think you scatter 1 out of 10 neutrons here, which is roughly what we expect to use. And so if you've enhanced low angle scattering, you've also actually suppressed large angle scattering because you just made your target thinner. Okay. If we compare that with some other radius, so for example, with 1 nanometer grains, you have less enhancement because the maximum number of atoms per grain is smaller. You just can't win that much. But then you win up to larger momentum transfers. It'll turn out throughout this talk that 10 nanometers is basically optimal for everything you do. You can't win very much by going larger or smaller. OK. Great. We've sort of already talked about this. Here again, it is in terms of sort of characteristic scattering angle. Right? And again, this is nice because now the maximum on this kind of plot is just where most of your scattering happens. And so again, we see that in the black dashed line case, most of your scattering happens at large momentum transfers. But if we switch to something like 10 nanometer structures, then now actually the majority of your scattering happens at momentum transfers of order inverse 10 nanometers. Great. One second. All right. So this is basically what we want, except for one huge problem, which is that actually this doesn't work at all. And it doesn't work at all because if you were to actually make a measurement from a target like this, the only thing you'd actually be measuring is the structure of your target and not anything from your new force. In fact, the typical thing that people do with neutron scattering is that they scatter neutrons from something with structure and they use the scattering distribution to determine the target structure. Right? That's going to completely swamp our effect. In fact, they even sort of look similar, right? The structure introduced a low angle bump. The new force is some low angle bump. You can't possibly detect a new force this way. But the thing that...
May I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Sorry, what type of temperature are you thinking of running this? Should I think of xenon as a liquid or a solid?
Xenon as what, sorry?
A liquid or a solid.
You definitely should, you almost definitely shouldn't think of xenon as a solid, although I'll come back to one exception to that. You should probably think about it as a liquid, although in practice, probably even the correct answer is you should think of it as a supercritical fluid. But yeah, exactly what temperatures we want to run at is the topic of ongoing discussion. So we'll come back to this later in the talk, but in the two material case, which is the easier one and the one we're trying to do first, you end up needing to run with two different noble elements, and you want both of them to be liquids or supercritical fluids. Probably you use xenon and argon. Now you either need to go to rather low temperatures and somewhat high pressures, or you can do this at room temperature, but you need very high pressures. Again, we're talking to people about what's going to be easier to implement in practice. So it's a little hard to answer your question precisely just because, ongoing debate.
Yeah, so when you have two liquids, don't they mix together?
Oh, sorry. You're going to be using them one at a time. I should have been clear about that. You're going to use one. Yeah, you're going to use xenon, and then you're going to separately use argon. They're not both present at once.
And I should think of them as a bunch of droplets in your case.
Good. So we'll talk about specific materials later on. Again, in the two material case, you're going to have some kind of ceramic with pores in it, and then those pores are going to be filled with either xenon or argon. But we'll come back to this.
I see. Okay. I see. I understand.
Thanks. Can I ask you something else?
Yep.
So in the end, you're just measuring distribution of neutrons in a screen, far away mm-hmm. or something, right? Do you care? So the only thing that you know is that the neutrons scatter. You don't really know if the scattering was elastic or inelastic. Do you care if all the scatters are elastic?
So First, for the targets we consider, the dominant form of neutron scattering is just elastic. There's not a big inelastic contribution. That being said, you can actually measure neutron energies to a certain extent, because the way that you measure these is essentially calorimetry, and you get some measure of how much energy the neutron deposited. I don't know how great that is off the top of my head, to be fair.
I see, but is that like super well known that all the scatters are elastic? Because I can envision like a thing that like a neutron scatters and there's some inelastic process that it's say resonant. So the neutron like resonantly provides a transition of something.
I mean, people do lots of neutron scattering and they do measure the energies of the neutrons that are coming out. Yeah, you can optimize detectors for this. Now, whether there could be some, the thing I'm slightly less sure about and the reason I'm hesitating to answer too firmly is I don't know to what extent people have like simultaneously measured both very small angles that we care about and also careful energy distributions, right? If you, my recollection is that in general this isn't a problem, but yeah, I don't want to say anything too firm.
What if the scatters like at small angles are not all elastic? Say that like, I don't know, like 20% of them are inelastic. Then will you care? Like, would it be different for your experiment? I guess it will change your predicted angular distribution for the neutrons and also for the feed-force scatters, because those would also be presumably to inelastic scatters. And then your signal computation or something will be different.
Right. Good. No. So you need something precisely theoretically predictable to compare to be clear, right? The thing that we're looking for is a deviation from this very angle-independent behavior. Now, if it's not angle-independent and you have a good, you know, if you have some very good prediction for what that inelastic contribution should be, then fine, you can still compare to that. If you don't, then you have a problem. That being said, I am fairly certain that there is not significant inelastic scattering at these angles. Again, lots of people have measured this before. The new part of our technique is the enhancement of small angles, but people have measured the small angles before. They just had poor statistics. Good. Right. So this doesn't work because you can't distinguish a new force from just some change in your structure. But the thing that saves you is that all of these structure effects that I'm talking about are purely geometrical, right? They were the result just of the positions of the different atoms, and they don't care at all about what you're scattering. And so what you can do is instead of just scattering neutrons, you can also do a measurement where you scatter X-rays. And for example, a ratio of a neutron measurement to an X-ray measurement is now structure independent, because this geometric contribution of structure is exactly the same in both cases. As a sort of very explicit case of this, you can think about measuring the ratio of an X-ray distribution from your material with structure and from your material without structure, right? And that ratio is just the structure factor, in some sense by definition, up to some normalization. And now you can just divide the structure factor out of your neutron distribution and you get a prediction from what your neutron distribution would have been for the material without structure. Now, this seems a little bit roundabout, right? That we're doing all of this work just to measure the neutron distribution from an unstructured material, which is the thing that we have a good theoretical prediction for, and so now we can predict to a Now we can compare that to a standard model prediction and see if there's a deviation. But the point is that these three measurements can be made to all have much better statistics at small angles compared to this measurement, which has this direct measurement, right? The measurement just from xenon gas or something, which has very poor statistics at small angles. So this combination of measurements can still do better, substantially better, in fact, than you would have if you had just scattered from xenon gas. Okay, so fine. We do a combination of neutron and X-ray measurements, and then that combination now gives us something we can compare to the standard model.
And the X-ray measurements have been measured at small angles with the kind of precision, because this I know for a fact, and I think I was asking about this yesterday. So I know that in direct detection experiments, you scatter X-rays of like a solid, and then you are looking for quantum scattering, and part of it is just inelastic in the sense that the X-ray quantum scatters an electron. It gives a little energy to the electron, creates like ionization, mm-hmm. and that's not theoretically predictable. I'm certain about it, because it's a really complicated problem, and people do theoretical approximations, and in the end, what people do, they just measure it. In the
quantum tail. Sure. No, I believe no. So these X-ray measurements have not been done. I mean, part of what our experiment will be, so you will need to do these X-ray measurements from the targets we consider.
I see.
This is sort of critical because to be clear, you need to do this with the exact physical target you're using, not even the same kind of ceramic. You should not trust that to the one in a million precision we need, two different copies of your ceramic have the exact same structure at these scales.
You need the angular distribution of that X-ray scatters, and there you're saying you're just going to measure it, but that could have a significant inelastic contribution. But you don't know if that's the case.
Yeah, in general, I don't know as much about the X-ray side of things. The experimentalists sort of assure us that the X-ray side of things is easier. In general, it is so much easier to scatter, to produce X-rays and so on. I agree that in the X-ray case, there is more inelastic scattering. I think it's also easier to measure the energies of the X-rays that come out, however.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Good. So then you can just distinguish the elastic and inelastic components, okay. I expect. But I'm not an X-ray, an expert on X-ray scattering. But I think that's how this should work. Yeah. Okay, so Jianwei, you were asking earlier about targets. So as I've sort of emphasized, the single material case is theoretically nice, not clear that you can do it, but there are some materials you could try to use. One of them is you can actually form snow, for example, from xenon. By snow, I mean some weird little low density solid state. This is a picture of it. If you cool down xenon in the right way, you get something that kind of looks like snow. Nobody's really characterized this well enough for us to actually know if it has the right properties for us, but it might. It's sort of fun. Maybe you can do this with other noble elements. Maybe more realistically, you can try to form aerosols, right? You can aerosolize all sorts of liquids, including probably xenon, although we don't know that anybody's ever tried, because why would they? But conveniently, at least based on other liquids, you predict at least that xenon should aerosolize conveniently into droplets of roughly the right size, right? These sort of several nanometer scale droplets. And that's the right size, and in general, this is pretty nice. It has all the properties we want, except, of course, they're not just going to hang there, right? You don't get to measure from a single suspension of aerosol droplets. They're going to be falling. It turns out that that's OK. Actually, if you run back everything I've talked about, you can just look at time-averaged scattering distributions and time-averaged structure functions, and everything is OK, up to one caveat, which is that you need to be very, very certain that the structure factor, or equivalently the droplet distribution that you're producing during the neutron scattering part of your measurement and the X-ray scattering part of your measurement is really the same, up to, again, something like 1 part in 10 to the 6. This is something of a concern. It's just, I mean, it's hard to keep things consistent to 1 part in a million. It's almost the case that we could fix this just by doing neutron and X-ray measurements simultaneously, which is a thing that people do. The problem is that you can't quite make your neutron and X-ray beam lines on axis. They have to be at slightly different angles just sort of for physical space reasons. And again, we can't really afford to have slightly different angles because you worry that your structure factor is slightly different at slightly different angles because probably you're producing the droplets in some direction. So we haven't quite figured out how to make this work, but it seems like it's kind of close and maybe eventually this is a thing that you can make work. But for now, we're being conservative and we're not promising to be able to do this. Sort of analogously, you can boil liquids, and then you have little pockets of low density within a background of high density. This is probably like the aerosol case, but just in a lot of ways slightly worse, but maybe for some reason it would work better. Okay, maybe, but you have to get lucky. Let's see, I'm doing okay on time, but let's probably still skip through statistics. You can ask me about them afterwards if you're interested. And let's just quickly show some projections. So here I'm plotting couplings, g squared, in, let's say, inverse GeV squared, but the neutron has a mass of 1 GeV, so if you prefer, you can think of these as dimensionless. As a function of your force range, lambda, or if you want, the mediator mass mu, on the right are strengths relative to gravity. And this black region is what's been excluded by previous experiments, right? So again, you'll see this 10 nanometer cutoff that I was emphasizing earlier, where at lower ranges, you have neutron scattering experiments or neutron interferometry. And at higher ranges, you're looking at collections of atoms. The black dashed line, actually, let's come back to the black dashed line even. Let's start with, let's say, the blue solid line. Right, so I said earlier that 10 nanometer grains are about optimal. And so this is, let's just suppose that somehow, maybe through an aerosol, maybe something else, we're able to form a target where all of the xenon is in spheres of order 10 nanometers. It doesn't need to be super precise, but somewhere around there. Then this is the kind of sensitivity we could get using about a day of beam time at a modern neutron facility. Right, and a day is, you know, not a crazy amount of time. These facilities are hard to get beam time on, but you can get a day. And so as you can see, you can get, you know, a few orders of magnitude over several orders of magnitude in force range compared to existing experiments. Yeah.
Sorry, like you said, like about, like the size is like 10 nanometers. So how much of the total material do you need?
Oh, how much xenon do you end up needing in this case?
Yeah, like each one is like 10 nanometers.
That's right, yeah. So I've set the total target thickness to be whatever makes 10% of your neutron scatter. Again, this 10% number is roughly correct for controlling multiple scattering. If I remember correctly, that turns out to be a few centimeters, but I forget the exact number right now. It's not a very large amount of xenon, if that's your concern.
No, like I'm more like wondering like how well like you need to arrange like these 10 nanometer like objects.
Well, again, remember.
I see. Okay, I was thinking about it.
Like, yeah, I mean, remember that we assume the different grains are in fact at random positions. So in a certain sense, the thing you want to worry about is just that they're not too ordered. We want them to be disordered. Right, once they're ordered, you start to enhance very low angle scattering where you have coherence between different grains. Okay, yeah, so this is just some scattering of 10 nanometer grains. And as I said, right, so you're winning a few orders of magnitude over this whole parameter space. That being said, this is a little bit deceptive because actually one of the things we've assumed, as I said, is that you have a day of beam time at a modern neutron scattering facility, and nobody has bothered to just perform measurements from xenon gas with a day of beam time at a modern facility. So if you just did that, you would get this black solid line, right? And so, okay, part of the parameter space that we're winning is we're just assuming you do this measurement better, right? You just have more neutrons hitting your target. But the key point, right, is that as you get to longer range forces where coherence is more significant, you can actually see some significant improvement between this xenon ideal gas assumption of the black dashed line and the blue solid line where you've introduced structure, right? And you're winning another couple orders of magnitude based on that fact.
This is statistics limited, so this bounds.
Good, that's what I was about to get. Yeah, so all of these are lines from statistics limits. This black dotted line corresponds to essentially a systematic error of 1 part in 10 to the 6, right, in terms of the fraction of scattering that is the result of any effect we haven't considered. We are fairly certain you can get to this black dotted line, right, and you'll notice it's well below all of our lines, so that's fine, we are statistics limited. In reality, we think you can actually do quite a lot better than this. These are very statistics limited measurements. You can control your systematics very well.
Can get particle in a million identification, for instance. So because you need to identify X-rays versus neutrons, right?
What do you mean by versus? You're doing scattering of one at a time. Probably.
Right.
Probably. Yeah. Okay. That's an interesting point. That if you were trying to do both simultaneously, you might worry about that. Because that's a pretty speculative thing. I can't say I've thought about it carefully, and I don't know how well you can discriminate. Yeah. Probably pretty well though, given that the X-rays. We were discussing this yesterday. The X-rays have to be somewhat higher energy than your neutrons.
Yeah.
Their kinetic energies are much higher. Even their momenta are somewhat higher. And so probably you can discriminate relatively easily, would be my guess.
If you're not doing them at the same time, would one, after you've done the scattering, does the structure of your material still look exactly the same?
Good. Yes, that is an excellent concern. So in practice, you definitely do measurements, probably you just alternate measurements periodically, or at the very least, you do like an X-ray measurement before neutrons and an X-ray measurement after neutrons, and you want to make sure they add up. Yes, you would definitely not believe a detection without doing that. In general, yeah, disrupting your material is something of a concern. For the single material case, it's generally less of an issue. Neutrons deposit very little energy, right? They're heavy, they have extremely small kinetic energies, and these are elastic scattering events overwhelmingly, so you deposit very little energy in your target. The thing you worry about more is whether your X-ray scattering is going to disrupt your target. For something like an aerosol, you're probably fine. You're changing these droplets all the time anyway. Okay, yeah, maybe occasionally you kick out an electron somewhere, it's just not a big concern. You're certainly not going to see some coherent effect where you've changed the properties of your droplet as a whole. In the solid case that we're going to come back to later, this is a little bit more of a concern. Currently, our impression is that probably you can choose materials that get disrupted little enough that at most you have to swap out your target a few times, right? And maybe you have to measure with a few targets, but it's okay, it's order one. But that is an ongoing concern that, yes, you need to be very careful that your X-rays don't just destroy your material. Yeah.
An X-ray is the only thing you can use?
Probably. In general, like anything you could scatter could work, but people don't usually probe these length scales with anything else. I think we played around with electron scattering at one point, but penetration depths are tiny.
Sorry, what's the energy of the X-rays that you're shooting?
So the X-rays, again, depends on the target. Something like 40 keV, we think, should be about right.
transfers of?
The Monroe transfers are order KeV, right? But the X-rays have to be somewhat higher on, or actually KeV or below, right? KeV is quite high for us. No, KeV is here, right? And we're mostly looking at even smaller than that. KeV is roughly KeV is roughly the momentum of the neutrons, and you would love to match that. Probably you can't quite match that because KeV X-rays get absorbed really, really badly. So you go to somewhat higher energy X-rays. If it turns out that that's a problem, for example, because it's disrupting your material too heavily, you can use lower energy X-rays. You just have to make your target thinner to compensate. In the process, you lose some statistics because fewer of your neutrons scatter. It's not the end of the world, but it's not ideal. So we're hoping to work with something like 40 KeV where this is less of a problem. Other questions about single material before I switch to the two material case? Okay. So good. So with that, let's talk about these.
I have another question. So how much do you need to purify your targets? You choose xenon because they have different properties, right? Like what level of contamination can you tolerate if you have some isotopes or like whatever?
Good.
Good.
So this kind of comes back to this 1 part in 10 to the 6 thing, right? So we need not quite 1 part in 10 to the 6 in general is sort of a generic like number to keep in mind. So if you can purify to 1 part in 10 to the 6, you're definitely golden. And in reality, you don't even need to do quite that well.
Is this true? Because like some of the atoms might have like a really, really bad form.
So one of the reasons we choose, there's not really a lot of atoms that scatter. You don't have atoms that scatter more than order one more than xenon. So they contribute about as much as a xenon atom, with a few very specific exceptions that you can hopefully get out of. There are very few isotopes that scatter all that much more. At 1 in a million also, you actually no longer really have coherent enhancement of scattering from the other isotope because now you have order 1 per grain. Although it coherently enhances with the rest of the xenon in it. Yeah, so one part in a million, which is already pretty achievable, is definitely enough. And then depending on correlations between, I guess in the liquid cart, you don't really have correlations. So let's say 1 part in a million.
Okay, thanks.
Have scatters from the beam line, so the neutrons were coming right from a beam hole. They will scatter on the walls.
Oh, of course. That comes up in these experiments always. So you also measure with just no target. The point is that as long as that's not coherently summing with what's in your target, you can just subtract it out.
I see.
The thing you worry about, and we're going to come back to this in the solid case, is when you have some structure that's correlated with the position of your noble gas, and now there's a significant interference term between the two of them, and that's more of a problem. But when it's something in the beam line, there's no interference and you're fine. Yeah. Okay. So as I've mentioned, it's pretty hard to make noble elements form nice 10 nanometer structures. They don't tend to do this. Solids, on the other hand, do this all the time. We can produce lots and lots of solids that have structures on 10 nanometer length scales. And broadly speaking, you can think about two categories of solids like this. One that I mentioned earlier are porous ceramics. So you can produce ceramics that have little 10 nanometer holes in them. And then you can try to fill these holes with something like xenon. The other category are things that look kind of like sand, right? You can imagine a pile of little grains, and then there are spaces between these grains, and you can fill those spaces with some noble element. And either way, you now have some structure given to your noble element at the cost of the rest of your space being filled with a solid. And if you remember way back near the beginning of the talk, I mentioned that noble elements are great because they have no magnetic moments, and therefore you don't need to worry about the neutron's magnetic dipole moment. Solids don't have these properties. They have all sorts of fun magnetic moments inside of them. And so electromagnetic scattering from them is an absolute mess, and you cannot possibly hope to predict it. Probably. At the very least, conservatively, let's say you can. So we're going to need some way to subtract out the contribution of the solid. Good. So before I talked about this concept of a structure factor, right, as an enhancement of scattering, you can still define an analogous thing in the case of the solid. I won't get into too much detail given time remaining. The main thing I want to emphasize, though, right, is that the analog of your structure factor in the two material case involves a difference in what's known as the scattering length density. So scattering length density for one atom is just the number density of the atom times its scattering length. If you have different atoms, add them all up. The point is that this is a sort of, well, it's the sort of density, an analog of just mass density seen by the neutron. And from the perspective of coherent scattering, neutrons can't tell apart things that have the same scattering length density. It's like it's the same material. So the thing that you get coherent enhancement from is the contrast in the scattering length density between your two materials. So ideally, you want that to be pretty high to have coherent enhancement. On the other hand, you also don't want the scattering length density of your solid to be particularly high, because then most of your scattering is happening from the solid, whereas we're going to want to subtract out all of the solid scattering and only look at the noble gas. So you really very much want a low scattering length density of your solid. This is going to be a bit of a problem for us. And it's a bit of a problem because if we look at just scattering length densities of different materials, so in the upper half I've chosen different noble elements, and the lower half I've chosen some example solids for which, for almost all of these, we know we can form structures. You'll notice that the scattering length densities of the liquids are generally quite a bit smaller than the solids. The exception here is argon-36, which is kind of a magical element and has an absolutely massive scattering cross-section with neutrons. But for the most part, solids are a lot more dense in the scattering sense than liquids are. And so that's going to hurt us, because it means that a lot of our scattering is going to be happening from these solids instead of from the noble element. That being said, and again, this is sort of an ongoing thing, we are currently talking to people at the neutron scattering facility about using much better materials for which these scattering length densities are smaller. And in fact, the thing that we're hoping to eventually use are materials with zero scattering length density. How is this possible? Well, it's possible because, again, remember, this is some sort of sum of atomic number densities times their scattering length, which is proportional to scattering amplitude, if you prefer. And you can find elements that have negative scattering lengths, right? Or equivalently, they have different signs of scattering amplitudes. Because of that, if you use the right combination of elements in some alloy, you can actually make the scattering length density vanish, and then coherent scattering just doesn't happen from that material. This is a thing that's already done, it's just less clear that you can make solids with the appropriate structure, which is why conservatively I'm not going to use them in this talk. But we're working with people on this right now, and we're cautiously optimistic that eventually you can, at the very least, you can eventually do this with solids that have much lower scattering length densities, and that'll improve things a lot. But for now, we'll be conservative. All right. So what does this look like now? You have some, and it turns out in practice to be a very thin disk, right, of some solid, let's say some ceramic. That disk is maybe a few centimeters across, and it's about a millimeter thick for typical solids. Actually, it won't depend that much on the solid because you always have the gas present. And maybe it's order half and half solid and xenon. Again, you don't depend on this too heavily, but just to have some characteristic numbers. And again, now, right, so you have this inside of some pressurized cell, you pass your neutrons through it, you look at scattering. Someone was asking me earlier about temperature. Generally, you were asking me earlier about temperatures. So if you don't want to deal with high pressures, you can do these things at relatively low temperatures, and you can do that at one atmosphere, and that's nice and convenient. The only problem is that in order for argon to be, I think it's a liquid here, not a supercritical fluid, I forget though, while xenon isn't a solid, you have to use somewhat different temperatures. And that does lead to some problems because you do have thermal effects from the motion of the atoms relative to the neutrons. That's mostly predictable, but it's still kind of messy. This probably needs to be simulated. So if you want to do things with identical properties of both the xenon and argon, probably you do something like a measurement at minus 100 degrees Celsius and something like 100 atmospheres of pressure. I think you could even do this at somewhat higher temperatures. You just need even higher pressures if you prefer. Good. So this is doable, right? It's a little bit annoying. You need a very much a pressurized cell at 100 atmospheres, but it's not like it's impossible. And there are ceramics that survive at 100 atmospheres perfectly fine. Okay. The other thing, and you had started asking about this, Daniel, right, is scattering from the beam or, for example, from the windows of your cell, because you do now have some pressurized cell that this is all sitting inside of. Again, you're totally okay with scattering from those windows, so long as it's not correlated with scattering from the gas itself, right? But presumably your gas is filling the cell as a whole, because the cell is the thing that's containing your gas. And so if there are structures in your cell windows at, let's say, 10 nanometer scales, then now all of a sudden you have a problem, because you're going to get exactly the same kind of coherent enhancement of the gas at the windows as you are from the target, and you can't subtract that out as conveniently. It's possible to polish things at 10 nanometer scales. It's hard, but it's a doable task, at least with many materials, including ones that are used for this. Okay. Okay, I'm running out of time, so just very quickly. So here again are our plotted structure factors, but now these colored purple, yellow, and green lines are combinations of different materials instead of just xenon. And the only thing you need to take away here is that you can still get large structure factors, in fact, pretty comparable structure factors, that will still make most of your scattering happen at small angles. As you recall, that was really our only goal. We just wanted most of the scattering, right, for this peak to happen at small angles. You can still do this with two materials. Okay. But now the problem, right? The problem is that now your total scattering cross-section is given by the sum of the total amplitudes from the gas and from your solid, that thing squared, not from the individual sums of scattering from the gas and scattering from the solid, right? There's some cross term where you have interference between scattering from the gas and scattering from the solid. And that thing's a lot harder to subtract out because you can't just take a measurement of the solid with gas in it and a measurement with just the solid and look at the difference of the two. It turns out that you can deal with this. It's just a mess, right? And in particular, it's a mess that requires you to take measurements from just the solid, but then also the solid with one noble gas and the solid with a different noble gas, right? And the reason this is advantageous is, of course, you have the same structure in both, so some things are shared, right? But of course, other things are different because you have different scattering lengths for the two. Nonetheless, with enough different measurements, in particular, you take X-ray measurements and a neutron measurements from those three things, right? Solid, solid plus, let's say, xenon, solid plus argon. And then also, of course, you still take X-ray measurements of just the xenon and just the argon. That gives you enough different measurements that you can, in fact, control all of the different effects contributing to this, right? There's just enough degrees of freedom. And so you can separate everything out. Okay, so it's possible to do this. It's a little bit messy. You're going to be dividing your beam time now between three different measurements, so you're losing some more statistics off of that, but it's not the end of the world. Here are the projections from that, and we'll do a comparison in a second. Here again, right, so this black shaded region is previous experiments. And now, for example, purple is 10 nanometer structures using xenon and argon inside of silica. Silica is a nice material. You can form gels in it that have high porosities, including pores of roughly these sizes. So this is basically an off-the-shelf experiment, right? You purchase the silica, you flood it with xenon and argon, and you take measurements at a standard neutron facility. Right? It's a very easy thing to do. As you can see, this gives you some advantage over existing experiments, although it's not enormous. You are very much statistics limited now, right? The systematic limits the systematic errors are much further. Okay, we'll compare this to the single material case in just a second. So the one other thing I should mention before I show sort of a summary plot is that I've been talking about experimental constraints this whole time. There are astrophysical constraints on these kinds of new forces just because you're introducing some new light particle and it's going to be produced in large quantities in the centers of stars, and that's going to affect stellar cooling, right? That depends a lot on your model. If you're looking, so in a lot of this talk I use just sort of for simplicity things that are B-coupled. In other words, they couple to nuclei in effect. In that case, the limit is about 10 to the minus 24. Again, I'll show the plot in a second, but that's a little bit off the bottom edge of our plot. If you look at maybe a B minus L coupled scalar, which is arguably a better motivated thing, you have some much stronger constraint, right? And it's really hard to compete with astrophysics. This difference is the result of B minus L coupled things coupling to electrons. And electrons are light. They're moving around a lot faster in stars, and so you produce a lot more of this scalar. That being said, you can also model build out of these things, right? Extra dimensions, again, we're not sensitive enough to probe these in realistic models, but those wouldn't affect stellar cooling at all, at least not in this particular way. And in general, you can model build different things that will get out of stellar cooling constraints. So these are model dependent. Nonetheless, for a typical model, you should expect, right? So I said 10 to the minus 24, that's a little bit off the bottom edge of this plot. We're not at the point where we can really compete with astrophysics. But here's our summary. Right? As always, black is excluded previously. The black dashed line is just what we're winning off of assuming a better facility. And so you can see that you can win a little bit of parameter space in this silica two material case. You can win quite a lot of parameter space by assuming that you can do something with just xenon. And then the takeaway that I think you should have from this plot is that we expect in practice to be somewhere between these blue and purple lines. Right? This purple line is very conservative. It's like a really off-the-shelf experiment. You buy silica that you can just get. You put two gases in it, you take measurements at an existing facility, it's very straightforward. We think we can do a lot better by developing materials that have scattering length densities that aren't as horribly high. And so we expect to be able to do quite a lot better. If you can get to materials that really have zero scattering length density, right, which as I said is a thing people have done, they just haven't put these kinds of structures in them, you can get to almost the blue line. It's not quite the blue line because, again, you're taking multiple measurements and you're dividing your beam time and your backgrounds are a little bit different. But basically, you can get pretty close to the blue line. In any case, we expect to be somewhere between the two. And so you can get a good chunk of new parameter space that people haven't explored before. You're not competing with astrophysics. Astrophysics is really strong. But A, you can maybe bottle build out of that. And B, you know, we win a few orders of magnitude here, and maybe somebody more clever than us can come up with something that does even a little bit better. And so one day, hopefully, we can catch up. Okay. So that's the takeaway, right? By introducing structure into these kinds of targets, you can significantly improve on experimental sensitivity to nanometer scale new forces. Questions?
What is this U1
lambda week? Good, yeah. These are predictions you would get for the result of breaking some new U1 symmetry, either at the electroweak scale or at 10 TeV. So the coupling here is in effect what? Mu over lambda electroweak. Yes.
Modified force of the Yukawa form.
Mm-hmm.
And the couplings that you propose, I mean, that's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
But is there any reason why you don't assume or don't admit of something else, like 1 over r, but instead of 1 over r, say 1 over r or something else?
Oh, no, yeah, good. I should have emphasized this more earlier. Yukawa is just a sort of nice classic example. In general, we'll get pretty similar sensitivity. Well, okay, I mean, you need some fair thing to compare. But yeah, I mean, the point is that as long as you're modifying the scattering at low angles by a comparable fraction, I don't have the black dotted line here, but that would be 1 part in 10 to the 6, we're a little bit above that. Anything that modifies low angle scattering by a similar amount, we're gonna have similar sensitivity to pretty generically. Yeah, you don't care too much about what the exact force is. Other questions?
I guess I'm just struggling a bit to understand you're counting neutrons and counting X-rays in some color.
Sure.
You need to count them, I guess, very, very well. To say that your counting went wrong, say that you, can you distinguish 2 neutrons from 1 neutron in your detector?
I believe pileup isn't an issue because the rates here are small enough that it just doesn't occur meaningfully.
Oh, really? I thought the beams were...
The beam is a lot. However, we're looking at... So you can get... they produce these neutron detectors with very small pixel sizes. And so within a particular pixel, you're just never going to see pileup. They do, in fact, have good spatial resolution. They have much better spatial resolution than we typically need, and I'm pretty sure you can get out of pileup with that. That also depends, of course, on their time resolution, you know, the time resolution, right, how long they can resolve, but I'm pretty sure it's a non-issue. More generally, you don't care that much about, it's okay, you know, if it's, you're actually right, these neutron detectors do not detect 100% of the neutrons that hit them, they're not that good. That's okay, though, as long as you've characterized this, right? You measure in advance, you send a bunch of neutrons at your detector, you see what fraction of them are detected. You don't even need an absolute fraction, although I think you can even get that by putting, let's say, some better calorimeter behind it. But in fact, you don't even need an absolute fraction, as long as you know the relative fraction seen by different pixels. In other words, you've characterized their relative, the fraction of neutrons that each one sees relative to others. You'll get the right shape, and all we actually care about is the shape that you see.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't have a lot of experience with this neutron detector, so I'm struggling a bit to understand the...
Other questions?
If there are no more questions, thanks again, Zach.
Oh, thank you.